You ever have that fear? Maybe men don't have this fear as much. Perhaps they do. Ever have that fear, ladies, that you're going to go to a big event like your prom or someone's wedding or a big dance and someone else is going to be wearing the same dress you are? You know what I'm talking about? Okay, well, let me tell you the kind of fear that ministers have. The ministers have a fear that they're going to tell a really great anecdotal story in their sermon and then realize they've already told that story to the congregation before. Terrifying. So I want to let you know that over this past week, I went through every single one of my sermons that I've ever spoken here to see if I'd already used the story that I wanted to use today, and I have. It's my Pentecost story, and I already used it. So I'm going to use it again. And those of you that have not heard it, you will be dazzled and amazed because it's so perfect. And those who have already heard it, pretend to act surprised. Please. Thank you, Bruce. Thank you for that excellent gasp of surprise. I love that. So, years ago when my children were itty-bitty, like 2 years old, 3 years old, my friend was hosting a birthday party for her son. And at this birthday party, she held it in her backyard. There were seven children, all between ages 2 and 3. And she had one of those little plastic cars. You know the ones I'm talking about that are big enough for a child to get in and they kind of can kick, push? You know what I mean? Yeah, okay. How many of us have like had one of those when we were a kid, or our kids had one? Yeah, okay. So she had one of these. Now, what do you think happened with that party? All the kids wanted to play with the car. So all of us parents were so worried. We saw all the kids converging on this one car, and we were all up in the mix, right? We were so afraid that they were going to get everything all messed up. We were so afraid that they were going to fight, that they were going to push, that they were going to shove, that they were going to not be able to share, that we were all up in the mix. And we were saying, you know, use your words. Let's not push. No, he gets a turn first. Do we need a timeout? Let's set a timer. Blah, 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 blah. I don't even remember eating cake at that party because we were so busy micromanaging the heck out of these small children. So we have in today's scripture the miracle of Pentecost. But let's put the story into context. This is after Jesus has died, after Jesus has given his final parting instructions, go out to all the nations and make disciples of them. And then he's ascended into heaven. And instead of going out to make disciples of all nations, what the apostles do instead is they hide in a room with the door locked by themselves. They do this again and again. Now, I'm going to cut them a bit of slack. They were afraid. They were filled with fear because they were being persecuted because they had been part of Jesus' band. You know, the police were after him. People were looking for him. And if this was not an irrational fear, they had just watched someone that they loved very much, who had done nothing wrong, who was their friend and mentor, be arrested, put through a kangaroo court, and executed. So they had reason to be afraid. So when he said, go out there and spread the good news to all people, they said, how about if we hide in our closet instead and lock the door and not tell anybody where we are? It makes sense what they were doing. But the problem was, they were being Christians in a climate of fear where they were not in contact with their community. And this is really critical to understand their mindset because we watched them try to fill their ranks at one point. We watched them try to fill their ranks because they had lost one of the original 12. Judas, the one who betrayed Jesus, says that he killed himself after Jesus died. He was felt so guilty over what he had done that he killed himself. So they were down to 11. And so one of the things that I do when I'm not here is I help other churches grow. I teach them how to grow. And I remember reading books about this and articles about it years ago. And I remember reading a book where they said oftentimes when churches, you know, are in slow decline, they will say they want to grow, but they really just want to add a few people. They'll say, no, we actually just need like 3 new members. That's all we need to fill the 2 vacant spaces on the board and to bring our budget up to where it's supposed to be. That's all we need, 3 members, because we don't want to look and feel different than we look and feel now. And I remember reading this and thinking that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. No one would ever actually say that. 3 years later, I was consulting with the church, and I was asking them to think about goals, how much they wanted to grow, how many new people they wanted to come in. And they're talking about it, right? Well, maybe if we got 50 new people, think of all that we could accomplish. If we got 100 new people, wouldn't that be wonderful? And one person says, that wouldn't feel like my church anymore. We don't need to get that big. All we need is 3 people. 2 to fill those blank spaces on the board, and 1 person to help with our Sunday school, and we're covered. And I actually heard it with my own ears. I couldn't believe that they said that. So the disciples have been told to go out and make disciples of all nations, and they're down by 1. So do they go out to spread the word? No. Do you remember what they do? They narrow it down to 2 candidates to fill the spot, and then they cast lots to pick between the 2. And they get 1 guy whose name we never remember. That's what they did. So they were back to 12. They could hide in the room and figure that their ranks were filled at that point. So recently, a Pew survey has come out. And I've gotten the pleasure of hearing a couple different people preach about this and talk about this and write articles about this. And what the survey says is that Americans who self-identify as Christians have declined in the past years. 7 years ago in 2007, 78% of Christians, 78% of Americans self-identified as Christian. Now, 7 years later, it's down to 71%. Is this reason to panic? I think we should. This is the gist of the article. And people are weighing in on this. I went to an event recently where someone gave a sermon and talked about how we shouldn't give up hope. You know, God's still going to do something new. We should be trying something bold. This is an opportunity. But the understanding that this person had was that this is cause for alarm. So, what's interesting about this is that when it's talking about people who self-identify as Christian being at 70%, 80%, somewhere in that realm, and how it's declining, what they fail to mention is that in any given town, the highest percentage that we ever see of people who actively attend church on a Sunday morning is rarely higher than 17%. So think about this. Pick an average American city. 70 to 80% of the people will say, I'm a Christian. Less than 20% actually do something about it. So if people who are self-identifying as Christian is going down, what does that mean? What does that mean? And when we look at this, and we look at how congregations are in decline, we have to ask ourselves the difference between walking the walk and talking the talk. Does that make sense? Now, I've talked in the past about the difference between people of the way back in the book of Acts. It says that people who followed Jesus were not called Christians. They were called people of the way, capital W. Now, have you heard of the Tao? Yeah, what does the Tao mean? The way, right? Because the focus is on taking little steps together, one day at a time, to make ourselves better people, to do something right by our community, make it a better place, and to take a step closer to God, hand in hand, little steps, little steps. Once the word Christian came into play, it was used by people outside of Christianity to identify them as a group of non-desirables. Because they didn't understand the steps that were being taken. They just knew that there was something about Christ in the middle of it. And once that happened, I think that the conversation changed. It stopped being about taking little steps every single day, and it started being about what you believe. And we've been arguing about that ever since, about what people believe about Christ, about what people believe about Christianity. But the original goal has not changed. People of the way take small steps every single day to make themselves better people, to make their community better places, and to move a little bit closer to God with each other, hand in hand. We don't do this by ourselves. We can't do it in a vacuum. So the following year, she has another birthday party for her son. Now, over the course of the year, what we did not realize was that every time she was at a garage sale or a little thrift store, and she happened to see one of those little plastic cars for $5, $10, she bought it, right? So when we went to this birthday party and go into her backyard, dreading dreading another repeat, we see that there are seven children and seven cars. She had a little car, she had a little van, she had a little red fire truck, seven cars, seven children. We thought, this woman's a genius. What do you think happened? What? They all wanted to drive the same one. Which one did they want to drive? The little fire truck. See, now I know what you guys were like at birthday parties when you were little. They all went after the fire truck. And us parents were just in the mix again. Oh, use your words. Take your hands off. Let's take a turn. You got to do two at a time. You can't have all three in there. No. Let's set a timer. Do you need a timeout? And so on and so forth. I don't remember eating cake at that one either because we were too busy micromanaging the fire truck. So on the day of Pentecost, the apostles are up in this upper room. And the Holy Spirit blows through. All their fear that they have, all of their isolation, it just blows through like a mighty wind and compels them out onto the street. It doesn't ask them politely if they would like to go out onto the street. It compels them out onto the street. It forces them out the door, and all of a sudden they are talking to anyone who will listen out on the street. And I remember this passage used to confuse the heck out of me. What was it that they said? Because as you read down the chapter, you hear Peter gives this great sermon, and 3,000 people decide to convert that day. And you heard the listing of how diverse this population was, and yet 3,000 decided to convert. 3,000 decided to accept the call, and 3,000 decided to join this first Christian community, which was actually quite harmonious. They lived in peace with one another. They shared food. They shared responsibilities. They got along with their neighbors, even the ones that weren't in the group. They welcomed newcomers day by day and ate their food together in each other's homes with glad and grateful heart. How did we go from 12 isolated, fearful people to that kind of community that fast? What was it that they talked about? That they talked about God's deeds of power. That's what it says, God's deeds of power. And what's interesting about this passage is when they talk about God's deeds of power, that's a pretty loaded language. Does it sound kind of cryptic almost? God's deeds of power. I think that they were just talking about what they'd actually seen with their own eyes, and they'd seen a lot, hadn't they? If you were following Jesus around for 3 years every day, you'd see a lot. And they had seen a lot, and they were sharing that with the people who would hear them. And in the process of going out on the street and being their authentic selves, they stopped being an isolated community. Whatever fear was driving them was gone. And in their lack of accountability, they were suddenly visible to everyone. And they were pouring out their hearts. They were being their most authentic selves to the community. I think that's what made the difference. Because it changed the way they understood their faith. It was no longer exclusive. It was not supposed to be small. They were not special. They were not perfect. They were suddenly very accountable to their own community. And they were speaking the truth, and that is what people judged them on. And they judged them very favorably, even though if they truly talked about God's deeds of power, they had to talk about their own fallibility. They had to talk about their own weaknesses. They had to talk about their own bumblings and their own questions and their own gaps in their own knowledge. And that's okay. That's what Christianity is really about. Being authentic, being honest with our flaws, and being embraced by community and loved by God anyway. So, in the wake of this survey, all of these articles are coming out. And in one, we see a response by a Republican senator, who shall remain unnamed, who is part of a conservative church, who started saying, you know, I wish we could just get back to the way it was like in the 1950s. I just wish everybody, you know, church life could just be the way it was in the 1950s. If we could just do that, we would have a moral rebirth in this country and everything would go back to the way it was. And what's interesting about that, a wonderful author, Rabbi James Rudin, talked about what it was like in the 1950s, because I've heard people mention that before. And in reality, the 1950s and the 1960s were the heyday of Christian churches in America. It's when our doors were the biggest. It was when our churches were the fullest. It's when our membership was the highest. And after about the mid-1960s, the numbers go into decline and have not come back. And this person talks about what it was like in the 1950s. And he says, you know, I don't know what she's talking about. I remember the 1950s. And it wasn't all picture perfect. It wasn't all leave it to Beaver. There were a lot of problems going on. They said that, I remember there was a bloody war in Korea that lasted for 3 years in the 1950s. Jim Crow laws were still around. Pardon? Joe McCarthy. We're getting to McCarthy. Joe McCarthy was around. We were engaged in a frightening Cold War with Russia. These were the days of racial segregation where people were fighting to hold on to it. There was no organized LGBT community back then, and few, if any, legal advocacy or support groups. It was a lonely, bitter time. He says one of my gay high school classmates committed suicide then because of the venom and the hatred he experienced. These were the years of the Red Scare. And during this time period, this was when, after the war, women were encouraged to reclaim their roles as wives and mothers, leaving the workplace and their positions in industry that they had gained during the war. And when we talk about how religion is changing and how Christianity is changing, and we look at this, I remember hearing a wonderful story by a Disciples of Christ minister. He's an interim minister, and so he works with congregations where they have had a long-term minister, and now they're re-examining themselves. They're looking at who they are, what they need to fix, what they need to change, and what they need to do to get ready for their next minister. It's a time of deep internal cleansing, if you will. And he says that there was a point where they were trying to change something. Some people in the church who were in charge were bullying. They were in control, and they weren't willing to let that go, and they were worried that if they stood up to these folks and tried to make a change in leadership, that the church would split. That was the big threat, right? The church will split. Half the people will leave. And people were unwilling to take a stand towards health. They were unwilling to take a stand towards truth. They're unwilling to let go of their fears and charge forth anyway. And he was trying to talk with them about this, and they were unwilling. They were simply unwilling. There was a lot of putting your foot down and drawings of lines in the sand. And in the midst of this, a woman who was 90 years old said, "So what if the church splits? I've been in this church for 90 years, and I've watched this church split 7 times. 7 times over women's right to vote, over segregation, over the civil rights movement, over the Vietnam War, and over lesbian and gay rights." And she said, "And every single time we split, we were better for it. Every single time we split, we were better for it." That's authenticity. That's truth. That's being accountable to your community. And when we look at what people believe Christianity is about, and what Christianity is actually about, Christianity is really easy when it bolsters our sense of privilege. Christianity is really easy when it tells us to maintain the status quo and enjoy all the fruits that we enjoy. Christianity is hard when we have to embrace people who are different from us. Christianity is really hard when we have to balance power, which means we have to give up our own. Christianity is really hard when we have to play by rules that benefit everybody. And every time the church has had to make a stand like this, it is split. Almost every single denomination right now either is wrestling with or has wrestled with becoming open and affirming to our lesbian and gay brothers and sisters. And every single denomination has split over the issue when they finally came down to that vote. And they lose about half of their churches. That happens in every denomination. The Lutherans, it happened to Lutherans, the Presbyterians, the Episcopalians, and the United Church of Christ. And every single time the church gets a little bit smaller, but they get a little closer to the truth. They get a little closer to accountability. They take another step on the way of looking deep into ourselves to become better people. doing something better to improve our community and taking a step closer to God. So when I hear these studies about how we've lost 7% of people who have self-identified as Christian, who cares? What are you doing on the ground right now that's making a difference? As denominations are going into decline, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? It's not necessarily a bad thing, because as they're going into decline, they're taking steps closer and closer towards equal rights for all people and towards improving the community for all people. So when I was in seminary, there was a courtyard sort of buried in the middle of all of the apartment housing for students with families. And we used to hang out there in the afternoons. I was there with my daughter, Rosemary, who was 2 at the time, and Faye, who was 5. And a lot of the students were graduate students from other countries, so we didn't all speak each other's language necessarily. And one afternoon, we were all there, and toys had accumulated over the decades, right? People would come and leave toys in the courtyard. And so one afternoon, I'm sitting there, and there were 7 families. I kid you not, 7 families. One was from Japan, one was from Germany, one was from the Ukraine, one was from Korea, and so on. 7 families, 7 languages. None of us could communicate. And guess what someone had left in the courtyard from years past? A plastic car. It was off in the corner, but I saw it, and I started to break out in a little bit of a sweat. And I could see the other parents start to break out in sweats as well. Their eyes got really big when we realized that the kids noticed it. First, a toddler started heading towards it, and then another toddler saw that toddler, something caught his interest, so they started going in the same direction, and very, very quickly, within about 2 minutes, we had 7 toddlers all heading towards one car, except this time, none of the parents spoke the same language, so we could not get all up in the mix. Do you know what I mean? We were terrified and helpless at the same time. So I found another article, and when I read it, I laughed out loud. I'm just going to share it with you very briefly. They're talking about a church in Denver who's actually growing. And the reverend is, the pastor there is Reverend Corbin Toby Davis. And all he can talk about is how excited he is to be a part of his church, which is what I tell people when people say, how are things going? I say, can I just tell you how much I love my job? I'll tell you, I swear. 3 weeks ago, I stopped by my mom's house on my way back from church. And I walked in. She said, can I get you a cup of tea? And I burst into tears. And she says, what's going on? And I said, I love my job so much. I love my job so much. I got to spend time with the coolest people being part of their lives today. It absolutely blew my mind. And I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to be part of this experience. And I see new people coming in the doors. I see new people staying. I see kids down at Pilgrim Park that have never come up here before popping by to say hello and bringing their friends, even though they don't have homework. Can you believe that? Kids coming to homework club and bringing their friends even though they don't have homework? This is huge. This is wonderful. I read these surveys about churches in decline, and I don't understand what they're all about, because the churches I've always been in have been growing and deeply involved in their community while we wrestle together with all sorts of struggles and questions. And so I'm reading this quote from this pastor who says, it really excites people to be part of a church that is doing something new, said Reverend Corbin Toby Davis. The church has started new things like an after-school program, parent classes, and talking about controversial topics like race relations and gay marriage. I'm so glad to know I'm not the only one that thinks that's funny. That's what we're doing. We're having real conversations, not just talking about heaven and something far off, beliefs, right? Belief system. But really talking about what does for us here and now, said Reverend Toby Davis. That's how Reverend Toby Davis believes they've kept its members and even grown in the last few years, which was a contrast to a national trend. The church has always been changing, said Reverend Toby Davis. The church has always been changing. You can tell with Reverend Toby Davis that he is fearless and authentic, wrestling with real issues, absolutely accountable to their community. And they're growing. So whenever we talk about our authentic selves, other people hear it in their mother tongue. We find ourselves in each other's stories. We find our hope in each other's struggles. We find our joy and our love in each other's similarities when we realize that no matter what color our skin is, no matter what gender we love, no matter what part of the map we come from, we have the same hearts. And when we share our stories, when we're truly our authentic selves, not arguing about what we believe, not telling people and micromanaging them, not speaking out of fear, but speaking out of truth, we come together. It's impossible not to do because that's how we're hardwired. So that day in the courtyard, I can see the other parents, their eyes are getting really big as there's like a zombie attack of seven children going towards one car. And there was nothing we could do about it except watch it happen. So the first kid gets to the car and hops in the driver's seat and grabs the wheel. The second kid comes to the car. Well, fortunately, it's a two-seater, right? So the second kid hops in the car as well and sits next to them. And there's a little wrestling over who's going to hold the wheel, but they sort that out. Third kid arrives. The car is full. The car is full. The third kid jumps right on top of the other two kids, and that's when we think, oh God, that's it. They're going to start crying, hair pulling, punching. The third kid squeezes between the first two, dead center, wiggle, 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 wiggle. There's arms and legs everywhere. Bloom. Squishes right down in the middle, all the same. And then they all start playing with the horn. Four more kids to go. The fourth kid comes. The fourth kid comes. And jumps on the side window, doesn't miss a beat, jumps on the side window, puts his feet on the window ledge, and hangs onto the top of the car. Fifth kid comes around the side and does the same thing. So there's three in the driver's seat, two hanging on the windows, two more kids. The sixth kid comes running up, and we think, uh-oh, who's he going to knock off? Who's he going to punch? He jumps up and lands on the roof of the car, spread eagle, I kid you not, hanging on, with his hands on the front of the top of the window and his legs kicking off the sides. And the third child, she comes running up and there's no place for her to go. Every single ledge is taken. She comes running up to the back of the car, grabs it, and starts pushing. And that thing started to move. And the ones in the front started squealing with delight, honking the horn, trying to steer the steering wheel. The kids on the top and on the sides are laughing their heads off. And this giggly, wiggly, chaotic, unpredictable scene starts to move around the courtyard. It was hilarious. It was nothing that we could have predicted. It was something we were trying so hard to control out of our own fear. But the kids knew how to play with each other. They knew how to share. They knew how to be equals. They knew how to balance power. They knew how to make sure that everybody had enough. And as that thing moved around the courtyard, the parents, none of us could speak each other's language. But when we looked at each other in the eye, we started laughing together. Because even though we didn't speak the same language, even though not a word had been said, we all got the same joke. We all heard it in our own mother tongue. So do you hear me? Do you understand what I'm saying? It was Pentecost that day. It was Pentecost that day. If the kids can do it, why can't we? Can I get an amen to that?